Welcome, welcome, guys. We are back for another episode of The Lock. And joining me this week, as usual, is Dara. Don't touch him because he's on fire right now, O'Carney. Dara, you've been crushing the last fortnight.
Yeah, it's been pretty good. I feel like I'm just getting up every morning and playing poker every waking moment. But fortunately, it's been going well. When you're doing that in the downswing, it's the worst feeling in the world. But yeah, it's been very good. People have been asking me what I've been doing different and all the rest of it. And I mean, you're always making slight little tweaks, but I mean, the reality is I'm just winning flips now.
Well, always good to win the flips. Also joining us this week is a great friend of ours and the show. He is one of the game's greatest tournament directors. He is a festival organizer, a poker entrepreneur. He is also the creator of K Hold'em. In just 6 weeks' time, he will be bringing live poker back to Ireland. He is Nick O'Hara. Nick, welcome.
Hi, guys. How are you? Thanks for having me along. Always fun to have a chat.
It's great to have you, Nick. Let's just start right there. The IPO, this is the great news of the week. The International Poker Open is happening, and it will be the first live poker in Ireland. And I want to say like 20 months or like 18, 19 months. It's definitely in that region. For the fourth time, the event will be sponsored by Unibet Poker. The festival is one of Europe's longest running and most popular events. It's been held annually since 2007, including an online version played on Unibet last year. This year's live event will take place at Dublin's Bonington Hotel, as it has been for many years. It will be on from October 20th to 25th. Nick, this is very much your baby these days. Tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned the lockdown. The last major live event in Ireland was the Unibet Open in February of 2019. So we were last out, and now it looks like we're first in. On the 22nd of October, our government are due to remove all remaining restrictions, which will lay the path for live events to recommence as they were before the whole lockdown. So, look, I mean, we're very excited about it. The government announced this about 10 days ago. So there's been a lot of work in the background over the last 5 days or so to get websites updated, the schedule updated, contacting staff, finalizing details with the venue. And we finally, yesterday morning at 11 o'clock, we announced the IPO online, which was brilliant. We had a huge response on social media. And the hotel contacted me. I think we announced it at about 11 o'clock in the morning. And the hotel called me at about 12 o'clock and said, like, what's happened? We're getting destroyed here with phone calls and bookings. And I said, like, what does that mean? They said, well, we've sold about 100 bedrooms in the last hour. I went, wow, that's an incredible response, you know. So I guess our advice to players is the bedrooms are selling fast, and we will only have whatever our seating capacity is. And judging by the response we're getting, there's a strong chance, certainly the Friday and the Saturday are going to sell out. So if people want to guarantee their seat, you can go to the IPO website, internationalpokeropen.ie, and you can register there, and that'll guarantee your seat in whichever flight that you want to play, so long as you do that. There will also be a direct buy-in available on the Unibet poker website, and that's going to go up there soon. Leo is in the process of organizing that, so we'll be monitoring there, and whatever capacity is, I do expect the Friday and the Saturday to sell out. So don't delay, get your seats. I think you guys are already booked in, so that's the good news.
Excellent stuff. Yeah, no, we can't wait. We've been talking about it all week, Dara and I. Dara, in the pantheon of Irish poker events, where does the IPO lie? It's obviously got lots of history.
Yeah, it has lots of history. It was actually the very first multi-day live tournament I played. The first year I was playing, it was in the RDS that year, and it was an absolutely mega affair. And that's essentially where it fits is, you know, the Irish Open is the Irish Open. That's obviously the tournament that's best known internationally in Ireland. But probably the best known European tournament. But that has, you know, 10 times the buy-in, or at least traditionally did. Obviously, the Irish Open buy-in has come down in recent years. But the IPO was aimed at, you know, the grassroots more. And it was sort of the huge grassroots event. And that's very much the place it very quickly occupied. It was the event where sort of just everybody showed up and had a great time. Also, it's always attracted a lot of overseas visitors, which is interesting for, you know, for that size of buy-in. But I think that came down to just the social aspect. It became such a huge sort of social occasion. Down the years, we've seen different things added. We saw Irish Poker Awards handed out at a couple of IPOs, the only times the Irish Poker Awards were ever actually a thing. And it's kind
this
of...
I had to interrupt. This is a shameless attempt to wedge in an old grievance of mine, I know, Dara. This is, I can't believe you're doing it again.
I'm trying to get you wound up, I do remember the only year they had a Blog of the Year award. Not only did you not win, you weren't even nominated. Say that you're not in the top five Irish bloggers was remarkable oversight and snub from the organisers. But yeah, but I think my point was, apart from trying to wind you up, was that... that kind of shows the place that the IPO has in the Irish scheme of things, that it was the natural place to have the Irish Poker Awards.
Absolutely.
The IPO, to be fair, is the brainchild of Stephen McLean. You know, he put the very first one together, and, you know, he's certainly an ambitious man. I remember the first year he was chatting to me about, you know, renting the RDS, putting on this huge event when... for the type of buy-in it was, I think the first one was €100 plus 20 in the RDS. And I remember when he was chatting with me, like, we were really busy at that time and we were doing a lot of events, but the thoughts of, you know, a €20 reg fee, massive event being held in the biggest indoor arena in Ireland was just mind-blowing. And to be fair to him, he aced it, he filled it, you know. And the McLean family have always been behind it. His father, his mother played poker. They always played the IPO. And Stephen's uncle, Leslie, who unfortunately passed away not so long ago, he was always a great character at the events. And this year, the IPO High Roller is going to be a celebration of Leslie McLean. So we're calling it the Leslie McLean High Roller Celebration. So we're really looking forward to that. And I'm sure Stephen and his family will be there, and just nice to remember Leslie. I remember the first time I met Leslie was actually in the Fitz, and as I was walking in the door, I just got chatting to him. We'd never met before. We shook hands. We had a little bit of light banter, and he straight away just said, do you want to swap 10%? And I said, yeah, sure, why not? And we both went on to make the final table that evening, and it was just great, you know. A guy I'd never met in my life was like this new friend I had all night, you know. So really looking forward to, I suppose, celebrating Leslie, and he will be missed at the poker tables. Well-known player at the IPO.
Yeah, that's a great touch, Nick. And also a thin brag for you making, I assume, what was your last final table as well? When you were...
And first as well.
Well, look, this week, the WSOP announced that there will be no masks at their event. They tweeted the 2021 WSOP will operate under the mask exception set forth in Nevada's emergency directive released by Governor Sisolak on the 2nd of September. With all attendees required to be fully vaccinated, players will be able to remove their masks while seated at the poker tables. These are the kinds of things that I think a lot of poker players who have been playing online or not playing at all for the last while, but are watching very closely, are concerned about, are wondering about. What measures or precautions will the IPO be taking, and will it sort of be similar to the World Series and their measures?
Well, I guess, I mean, look, the first thing to say is no matter what decisions we make in terms of the whole COVID-19, we're not going to keep everybody happy. Unfortunately, COVID has somewhat, you know, divided society a little bit in terms of, you know, some people are pro-vaccine, others are anti-vaccine, and there's a lot of people somewhere in the middle. So, look, we're not going to keep everybody happy. All we could do is make our best decisions and what we feel is in the best interest of the game and the safety of our staff and the players. So, thankfully, I mean, as far as the pandemic goes, it looks like we can see light at the end of the tunnel and the potential finish line, which is great news, but it hasn't gone away. It's not gone. So we looked at what the Irish government are doing and what the international kind of standard is at the moment. So the Irish government are due to lift all restrictions on the 22nd of October. There will be zero restrictions anymore in terms of COVID-19. And we do have people arguing with us that, look, you know, if the government say there are no masks indoor, well, then surely that's good enough for you. And we're kind of saying our approach is that this is an international event. We're welcoming players from all over the world and certainly all over Europe. And a lot of people are going to be flying from different countries coming in, and where they're coming from may not be as relaxed, and it's not what they're comfortable doing. So we have to take that into consideration. So our policy is going to be that we're only allowing vaccinated or people who show a negative PCR test within 48 hours of their initial entrance into the poker room. That's for both players and staff. And upon arrival, for the first time when people arrive into the room, they'll have to show us the vaccine cert or the negative PCR, and we'll be putting a wristband on their wrist. That'll stay there for the entire duration of the event. So upon entry to the room, once you can show you have that wristband, you'll be allowed to enter the room. Each morning, we'll be doing a temperature check on each player, and as they enter, there'll be a different color wristband for each day. So as you come in on Friday, your temperature will be red. Perhaps on a Friday, we'll use a yellow wristband. That'll go on your wrist, and that's there for the day. So as you walk in and out on the Friday, you must show your green wristband and your yellow wristband. So that way we can ensure that everybody in the room has at least the vaccine or the PCR test. And in addition to that, that we've checked each person's temperature each day coming in and out. When they're in the room, we've taken into consideration things like we're going to have fewer tables in the room. We're going to be taking out some of the tables to give a bit more space. There'll be extra ventilation in the room. There'll be doors and windows open that we don't normally open. And we're doing things like we're going to do a closed dealer rotation. So for anyone who doesn't know what that is, normally each dealer during the day could potentially deal on any table during the day and they all move around the room. We won't be doing that. What we'll basically do is allocate five dealers for tables 1 to 4, and that's their job for the day. They won't go anywhere else in the room. And we'll allocate a different five dealers then for tables 5 to 8 and so on. The dealers that are in those rotations, we'll be doing our best to make sure that they're in the same shared accommodation, so that there's no point in us putting five dealers in a small group all day and then they room with different people at night. So we're going to try to make sure that they're rooming together. Each player, when they arrive at the table, will be asked to sanitize their hands. And that includes the dealers. When they come into a table, they'll be asked to sanitize their hands also. Anybody handling cash and such, or registration desk people, they'll be wearing vinyl gloves. They'll change them regularly. And we'll have masks and vinyl gloves available for players or staff who feel that they'd like to wear them during the event. In terms of whether or not a mask will be actually mandatory to wear during the event, we'll wait to see what the government announcement will be closer to time, and we'll make a decision then. I can't rule it in or out, without at the risk of sounding like a politician, but we need to just wait and see what the Irish government say closer to the time and what the situation is. Hopefully we don't have to wear masks. That'll be my feeling on it. But we do need to assess the level of risk and the government guidelines closer to the time to make that call.
Well, Nick, it sounds like you put an awful lot of time and thought into how to do it the best possible way. And I'm sure that will be appreciated by people, regardless really of their feelings about, you know, vaccinations and anti-vax and anything in between. Sure. You know, nobody can really argue with the sort of safety precautions you're putting in there. It is worth noting, and I want to point this out, that 88% of the adult population in Ireland right now are vaccinated, and that number should creep into the 90s by the time of this festival. It's further worth noting that less than 55% of Nevada's adult population are currently vaccinated. So it's likely that that number will stay below 60% during the World Series beginning at the end of this month. I think that's not an unimportant statistic in all of this. I think Ireland is approaching herd immunity, and that is what we really need to see. And with that in mind, events like this can happen, and that's clearly why the government have made that call. Dara, any thoughts?
Yeah, just a quick thought. Yeah, I'd echo very much what you said. I was talking to an international friend about this, and I said that Ireland's probably one of the best places to hold something like this at the moment because we have such a high vaccination rate. And while there are obviously some people who are anti-vaccine or vax hesitant, it's not as big a thing here as in a lot of countries. So I think I think that's a positive. The other positive is yesterday, the chief safety officer, Tony Holohan, announced that the infection rates is actually dropping in Ireland now. So I think by the time it comes around, there's a very good chance, as you say, the numbers will be very, very low.
Yeah, fingers crossed for all of that. Well, I mentioned there the World Series briefly, and I'm going to do a little nifty segue across to, I suppose, a piece of good news attached to the World Series. We've been hearing nothing but bad news and sort of indifferent news and complicated, nobody knows quite what's happening sort of news recently. But this is a nice piece of solid info. CBS Sports, who have taken over the coverage of this event from ESPN for this year and moving forward, have announced that Kerstetter, Chad and McCarron will be reunited in the commentary booth. Dara, Jamie is obviously the breakout star of commentary in the last, say, 4 or 5 years. She was rewarded, in a sense, by getting the top gig alongside Norm and Lon. It's actually hard to imagine somebody slipping into that role, joining them and doing as well as she has. Obviously, they've had analysts over the years as Fandiari, Helmut, Negreanu, but actually in terms of the type of coverage that really plays to a wide American audience who'll be watching it on TV, it might be the one time of the year they watch it, she really hits the sweet spot. Can you elaborate maybe on the ways Kerstetter's commentary sort of fits with the lads and why it's good for mainstream?
Yeah, I think, like in poker, traditionally we have two types of commentators. You have the expert commentator and the color commentator. And Lon and Norman were always in the latter category, which meant that they tended to rotate in and out guests. But in Jamie, they have actually somebody who is who plays at a high enough level to sort of fill the expert role. But she's also brilliant at the other stuff as well. She's basically the most versatile commentator in poker for that stuff. She's the sort of one person. Like as great as people like Nick Schulman and other people who do the expert commentary are, you can never really imagine them filling that sort of color commentary road. So she's really good at that. Her humor, her sense of humor as well, gels really, really well with Norman and Lon. I kind of feel sorry for Lon, because Lon's always had to be sort of the straight man to Norman, and now he has to be the straight man to two people. But Lon is such a versatile broadcaster as well that he's fitted into well. They have a wonderful sort of dynamic between the three of them, where she's kind of like the adopted daughter or something of the two older guys, and you have like bad dad in the form of Norman, who's throwing out all the jokes, and then Lon, who is the straight man. I think probably the key to her appeal as a commentator is just how funny she is. She's also very, very empathetic, I think. So she gels very well with the two guys, and she can sort of relay to the audience why they should care about what they're watching as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the adopted daughter line, because when I actually gathered in some quotes for an article I wrote on this, I showed Jamie the quotes from the guy. She goes, "Oh, it's so nice to have two dads." That was literally what she said as well. So you hit the nail on the head there. Nick, you often run events with live stream coverage. What do you look for from your commentary teams? And does it change whether it's like an EPT with a big buy-in versus maybe something, you know, more grassroots?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a difference in terms of the audience when people are looking at an EPT compared to one of our events. The likes of the IPO, we put a huge emphasis on fun. You know, we want a fun time for the players in the event, and we want a fun time for the people who are watching it. So a lot of the time, like when we're choosing which table to bring up or bring down from the TV table, you know, we're not going to pick a table where we're sitting there and they're all very dry. You know, we're looking for a bit of fun. We're looking for people who are characters and we're going to have a laugh and be entertaining. In addition to that, it helps a lot if there's a couple of, you know, technically good players on it. That helps the commentators to give them a bit of commentary content. And whereas on the likes of the EPTs and so on, you know, there's massive resources behind those, there's a huge team of people behind it. But I think the audience, the other end also, they're very interested in the technical end of it and the suspense end of it. You know, obviously it creates a lot of hype when you're sitting there as the audience at home and you can see the players' cards. You know exactly who's going to win, who's walking themselves into a big trap and how they're trapping. So definitely on the likes of the EPTs, I think there's big emphasis on the suspense end of it and the technical end of the game. Whereas during the IPO, we probably put a lot more emphasis on, local players having fun, enjoying themselves. And as we get it closer and deeper into the tournament, then we bring in a lot more of the technical stuff and the atmosphere changes in the room and everybody begins to feel it. And that just naturally feeds into the stream, I suppose.
I threw up a real softball from there, Dara, where he was going to mention us and how, our commentary has been really useful over the years. But he didn't even mention us once there. I just want to...
It's fantastic. It's great to have you guys on board. The best thing about you guys is I get to just walk away. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to think about it. So when you guys come in, I just go, great, they're here. And off you go, just leave you to it.
Well, it is a shame that I had to prompt that out of you, but it is a pleasure nonetheless. I actually dug up the quote there, Dara, because it was making me laugh when I wrote this VSO news article this week. Norman Chad's quote about Jamie was particularly good. I'm going to read it out. Jamie is a remarkable success story, he said. Middling college athlete, unhappy lawyer, so-so poker player, and then bang, I think we literally found her working on the street as an organ grinder in a New Jersey suburb. And lo and behold, we put a mic in front of her and she was a natural. So I think that really does speak to the sort of chemistry, as you mentioned there. Before we move on topic, Darrell, finally, I'd love to get your take on this. Speak, please, to the enormous contributions of Lon and Norm to poker.
Yeah, I mean, Lon and Norm, they've had to put a fair amount of criticism down the years from the sort of people that Nick was talking about who maybe watch EPTs rather than the IPO. And, neither of them have ever claimed to be a poker expert. But what they're very, very good at doing is communicating to a mass audience what they're watching is important and why it should be fun as well, even if they have like 9 stone-faced people in front of them. Norm will come up with enough jokes to keep people chuckling and just make it more relatable to the man or woman in the street. I think that's kind of their appeal. Having commentated with them a couple of times, I think Lon probably in particular doesn't get as much credit because Norm is obviously the naturally funny one and he's the one that comes up with all of the eye-catching lines. But Lon is the guy who keeps the thing on the road all the time, who basically fills all the dead air and also sets Norm up for the jokes. I think they are an amazing partnership, and it's great to see that even though the WSOP has obviously moved from ESPN, that's still being kept together.
Yeah,
who's the funny one out of you two?
Sorry?
Who's the funny one out of you two?
It's definitely Dara. My missus always says that Dara keeps her laughing. My mother listened to some recent episodes of Gibberish. She said Dara's the funny one as well. So I think I think the jury have already made their verdict on that one.
I'm not sure that's the mass opinion at all. I think, my wife says that I'm obviously the expert and David's the funny gobshite who doesn't know much.
I wasn't taking away the expert role from you either. I was just giving you both, to be honest. Anyway. Speaking of making contributions to poker, Rob Young made some news this week. He pledged a whopping $1.2 million for the creation and maintenance of a poker players union. This all started with a Twitter poll. Rob does love his Twitter polls, it must be said. Sometimes I feel like half of Party Poker's decisions over the last 4 years were made by Twitter poll. But maybe that's me just being a little bit salty. Roughly 2/3 of Rob's Twitter audience responded with the answer that they like the idea of a poker union that could lobby regulators, lobby poker sites, and promote the game in general. I must say, I like the idea in principle, but I also think it's doomed not to work. Rob's financial pledge will certainly help give it its best chance, no doubt. But ultimately, I just think players are too contrarian, probably too diffuse, probably too hard to wrangle. I think the fact that we are basically lone wolf sole traders means we're very difficult to galvanize, particularly into larger groups. Nick, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think the poker community, they're quite an opinionated group of people. And unfortunately, they generally don't share the same opinion. And I think it would be very difficult, to have a concentrated opinion coming from one poker community on most subjects that pop up there. Like, I mean, if I put something up on a forum, you know, the variety of replies you get and opinions is wild. You know, certainly we'd have common interests, you know, from different poker players, but for a very broad range of topics, I just think we're so divided. Even, you know, we could be at a tournament and maybe it's getting late and half the players want to stop because it's getting late. The other half want to continue. Some want to play on to burst the bubble. And in one tournament, you can't get an answer, you know. And we used to try, or I used to try, to approach the players when, you know, a decision was going to be made that would affect them. And we'd voice to them, look, this is what we're thinking. What would you guys like to do? And I just gave up because you couldn't get an answer. And my policy now is we just have to make the decision and go down and tell them this is what's happening, you know, because they're just, you'd spend 20 minutes, half an hour trying to arrive at a decision with a group of poker players that affects them all, and we can't get anywhere. And at the end, you're going to have to make the decision anyway. So look, with the best will in the world, I think it's, you know, it's worth a try. I think there's a lot of benefits involved in having a common voice that have representation, that carry a bit of weight. Whether the members themselves can agree on, you know, the actual topics and stuff themselves, that's yet to be seen, I think, you know, but go Rob.
Yeah, well, he is an entrepreneurial man and he is a generous man in lots of ways. So, yeah, fingers crossed for him. And it'd be certainly interesting to see the shape that takes. Dara, this is not the first time that the idea of a poker union has been floated. After the Poker Stars Supernova Elite scandal, players coalesced briefly to draw attention to, I guess, what is the most shameful bit of wrong ever perpetrated by a poker site onto a group of its own players. There was another attempt to galvanize last year as top pro Patrick Leonard attempted to sound the alarm about the detrimental long-term effects the poker ecosystem if operators were to continue a sort of a money-grabbing short-term sort of attitude. In fact, Patrick came on the Chip Race in June of last year and he sort of elaborated on those fears, pointing to the sort of consecutive and concurrent series that were taking place, the re-entry culture, the really, really probably record long or long late registration periods, which kind of are getting a bit silly now. Could a union realistically do anything to address Patrick's concerns?
I mean, I think the answer is in theory, yes, but in practice, you know, every attempt so far has failed. I think in the first attempt that you mentioned shortly after the Supernova thing, I was involved in the attempt to get it off the ground, and it basically took the form of a Skype group, or actually a number of Skype groups. There was sort of a central Skype group which involved ambassadors from all of the major sites, and then below that, in each country had its own group, and they reported up to one person on the central group. So if they had a specific concern, they would go to their representative on the central group, and then they would bring it to the central group. My memory of it is there was two massive problems. First of all, while you do need people who understand how the sites operate and, you know, what their current thinking on different things is, and who can maybe wield a bit of influence with the site internally, if the union decides something needs to be raised, it's not really in the interest of the ambassador for any site to sort of, you know, piss off their site. And I do remember the Stars representatives were particularly under pressure on that stuff at the time, because Stars were obviously seen as the bête noire of poker. So it's very, very difficult to get poker players to act against their own self-interest. The other thing which this attempt might actually have a better chance of overcoming was we very quickly reached a point where people were saying, like, okay, well, we actually need to hire somebody full time to do some of this stuff, this work now, because we, you know, we're all working poker players and we disappear on a Sunday, for example. So there was a suggestion to hire sort of somebody on the PR side, and then we were all being asked to kick in to pay for that person, and suddenly the idea died a death, because asking poker players to stump up money themselves for something like that is also difficult. So I think Rob's, you know, first of all, props to Rob for even attempting this. And just because it's always failed in the past, of course, doesn't mean that it'll fail this time. It's just, I wouldn't be massively optimistic. It'll very much depend on the people who are involved as well, I think. Because on the one hand, you know, you could get people who are completely impartial and say, okay, well, let's only get people who have no involvement with any site. But then the issue there is, you know, what sort of influence do they actually have? It's also very hard to reach sort of the poker masses. It's easy to reach the 1,000 people or whatever it is who are very engaged by poker Twitter and to come to the conclusion that that's the poker world, but it really isn't. That's like a tiny percent, less than 1% of the poker world. And when I communicate with people who are outside that 1%, it always staggers me. You know, there's some stuff that we think is absolutely massive and it's a huge story. They've never even heard of it. It hasn't registered with them at all. So I think that's an issue too. How would you involve those types of grassroots players as well?
Yeah, great points from both of you. I really appreciate your takes on that one. Moving on, Phil Hellmuth wants a rematch. Our friends over at Gamble Online have covered this story. So I'm really sorry, Dara. I was wrong on two counts. One, I thought there was no chance Hellmuth would want a rematch. And secondly, and maybe more importantly, I thought we could stop talking about Phil Hellmuth. But apparently we can't. Sorry, he's omnipotent. That's the way he operates. In a post on Twitter, Hellmuth announced, "I texted my boy Tom Dwan to let him know that I'm officially challenging him to a rematch for $200,000. That would be $400,000 total on high stakes duel. Tom is a great, great poker player and he beat me last match. I'm sure next round will be a battle. Hashtag positivity." And I no doubt he probably managed to get about four other endorsements in there. Nick, Hellmuth is unquestionably some character. Have you had to deal with him as a TD ever? And what do you think of his shenanigans?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mike Ward from the PCA. PCA would have been the first event that I worked that Hellmuth was playing in. And Mike's a great guy. And myself and Mike have worked quite closely together, and he calls me the no way guy and he's the whatever guy, you know. And my first time, I suppose, working hands on with Phil Hellmuth was during a PLO tournament during the PCA. And, you know, he wasn't doing too well. He was losing chips, and he becomes a bit more vocal when he's losing chips. He's less vocal when he's winning them. And there was like a relatively inexperienced player at the table. And, you know, I felt Phil was really needling the guy. The guy was winning chips from Phil. And I felt Phil was really needling him. And, you know, I treated Phil like I would any other player. I, you know, waited till he was on his own. I said, "Look, Phil, please, you know, it's not okay to needle a guy at the table like that, especially, you know, someone who is less experienced than you. We want the guy to come back and play with us again, and we need him to have a positive experience as well as you." And he just went, "Okay, no problem." And he sat down and he left the guy alone for the rest of the day. And I wasn't expecting that at all, you know. And Phil came up to me at the break and he said, "You're right, that guy's entitled to sit down and play his game. You're right." And that was it, you know. So from that day on, myself and Phil seemed to just get on well. And, you know, I never had a problem with him after that. He's entertaining. He's lively at the tables. But, from that point on, you know, I never had any reason to say anything to him again. But, you know, I'll treat it. All players equally, and I wouldn't let anybody else needle a guy like that, you know, especially someone who's relatively new to the game. You know, they deserve to have a positive experience.
Yeah, there's certainly a perception, I think, that TDs will give favourable treatment to the big names. Obviously, you've made it very clear that that's not something you would ever do, and nor would we expect that. But I want to know, have you ever been put in a spot where another big name sort of demanded preferential treatment, and when you would not give it to them, was there any fight back?
Like, exactly, obviously, what you're referring to.
You know, obviously, I'm not trying to, you know, end your TD career here, but I'm interested.
No, in Barcelona, I think it would have been 2017, maybe 2018, we had the high roller on, and it was a 10,000 buy in. And Daniel Negreanu was involved in an incident where at the time, the rule in place was that you must be at your seat for first card off the deck. If you're not at your seat for first card off the deck, you're not entitled to play the hand. And there was a dealer on the table. She called floor. I came over. She explained that Daniel wasn't at his seat. And I withheld the rule. And I said, OK, you don't have a live hand. And Daniel didn't take it very well. And he was quite abrupt, quite colourful and animated. And he made quite a big show in the room about it. And there was certainly a lot of pressure. And then some of the higher up people and stars kind of came in and were asking me, what the hell just happened? Twitter's exploding, you know. And I just said, look, this is what happened. That's our rule. And that's the way we dealt with it. And that's our procedure. The dealer on the table was a very experienced dealer and I trusted her. I got a second opinion. In addition to that as well, I mean, when we're called to a table, quite often, if a player is, you know, maybe there would be a feeling at the table that our ruling is unfair. The other players at the table generally voice up and say, floor, look, hang on, he was over there or he was this or, you know, and the players will generally jump in and they will, you know, tell the floor guy, look, you're missing this point, you're missing that point or whatever. And at that point, every player at that table just put their head down and nobody said a word. And, you know, that in itself does speak a certain amount that nobody jumped in and said, hang on, Florida, he was standing there or he wasn't over there. You know, not that that's our ultimate decision, but it's something that we would take into consideration that, look, nobody has jumped in here. You know, I think you've done it before where, you know, we arrive at a table and somebody's explaining a situation and you've jumped in and said, look, hang on, that's not exactly what happened. This is it from my perspective, you know. And yeah, I mean, you know, I'd be lying if I said that, you know, it's not difficult to make a big ruling against a well-known player and all the cameras are on you. You know, you're under pressure. And but at the end of the day, you know, the rules are the rules. Most of them are black and white and most of them are ABC for us. And that one was fairly black and white and ABC, you know.
Well, I'm keen to come back to you because I do want to ask you a few more stories a bit later on. But to conclude this segment of the show, that Helmuth Dwan match is on. It's officially sort of made, if you like, as a game, but there is no date for the encounter quite yet. A reminder to also check out another of Paul Seaton's articles, this one on selling action, which was dropped on Gamble Online this week. Why? Why should you do that? Well, because it features us, of course, Dara, isn't that right? Dara, this article is the product of his interview with us on the last episode of The Chip Race and a chat he had with Dan Smith. Holla. We've gotten pretty good feedback on doing the role reversal thing that we did on that show where the guest sort of flips the script and asks us the question. I couldn't help but take that personally, like I had done something wrong in the past and that I was due a replacement. Barry said it liberated me from the anchor role so the audience could hear my opinions more. But I thought about the audience hearing my opinions more. I thought that was a very dangerous proposition and maybe a recipe for the end of this show. Dara, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I did say to you before we recorded that segment that I thought it meant we were getting an upgrade in terms of the presenting role because Paul came in. Paul came did a great job, and I think we'll certainly do that as an occasional feature going on. In terms of the subject that we covered, I think it was relevant to this point as well because I alluded to it the last time we discussed the possibility of a Helmuth Dwan thing, and I said I think it probably comes down to whether Helmuth is backed or not, and I very strongly suspect he is in this match. I suspect that even more strongly now, and obviously I have no proof on this, but a good friend of mine, Jesse, shout out to Jesse, sent me a link to a podcast that some gentlemen who are apparently Helmuth's backers did. And I had heard rumblings that Helmuth was backed for all the big stuff for several years back, and I assumed this fell under the remit of that as well. So this would have been their decision ultimately, I think, and I think that's why we're seeing the rematch.
Yeah, he sort of makes no bones about that kind of thing. I remember seeing an episode of that No Gamble, No Future show, and he was talking to Negreanu on it, and Negreanu was sort of like, you know, waving around the whole, I'll bet you $1 million and I'll bet you $2 million. And Phil was sort of like, well, I'll have a word with my investors and we'll see if we'll bet. You know, it was very clear that Phil doesn't like stumping up his own money. He probably likes a no variance life. And, you know, he's reached a point in the game where he can probably manufacture that for himself. And well, why not? Nick, I want to come back to tough rulings. When you were first on the chip race many years ago, many moons ago, we talked about how you are a born diplomat. And we catalogued some of the times you successfully de-escalated situations. I wanted to ask you, apart from that very colourful example with Dean Eggs, what were the most difficult rulings you ever faced? Were there any times where it wasn't clear-cut what the right thing to do was, and there was a kind of a heavier emphasis on you interpreting the rules?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think probably the most tricky things, like the rules themselves are relatively black and white. Most of them, you know, they're black and white, they're ABC, we just go through the motions. I find what's more tricky is more things like, I don't know if you remember, I think it might have been actually the first time I met you. I was working...
I'm filled with dread right now. I'm scared of what I did, and now you had to come over.
I was in City West, and I guess it was probably an Irish Open event, and you were on a final table with Kat Taylor, and it was probably one of my first kind of big festivals like the Irish Open. I'm pretty sure it was the Irish Open. Can't remember. I'm pretty sure it was the Irish Open, but you were on a final table anyway. It was getting really late. Really late. It was like 2 a.m. There were still 8 players and the staff had been in since, you know, 11 o'clock in the morning. They're due back in at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. And there was no sign of this thing ending. And, you know, all the people that would have been above me were gone. And some of the players at the table were coming to me saying, look, you know, can we stop? We need to stop. It's getting too late. Others are saying, I have to work tomorrow. We have to keep going. And it was early enough in my career that I kind of, you know, I didn't really know who to side with. And I ended up having to just make a decision. And I think what I announced was that we were going to play 2 more levels at whatever the level duration was. Maybe it was a 1 hour clock. And then after those 2 levels, we were going to go to a 50% clock. Well, there was murder in the room. The remaining players, including you, were like giving me a terrible time. And they were kind of saying, look, you can't just change the structure. We've bought in, we've done this, you know. And I had the other half of the players saying, you know, look, he's right. And I was like, how do I solve this? You know, so I guess, you know, from that situation, I've learned we ride into it, you know, that the TD has the right to alter or change the structure, including adding a day, shortening levels. We wrote all of that in so that, you know, in those situations, we can walk down and say, look, it is in the terms and conditions. You know, this is what we have to do. So I guess, look, there are points during events where we have to make those decisions. Players probably don't see a lot of them, but behind the scenes, myself, Glenn, you know, Antonio, Brian, we're chatting about all sorts of things in the corner about stuff that, you know, could affect or may not affect players, you know, tomorrow or the day after. And they're nearly more tricky than the actual rulings. I suppose as far as rulings go, the most memorable one I have, and again, it was during an Irish Open, and I still to this day have no idea how it happened. I was called to a table and there had been a fairly big pot. Like they gave me the amount of chips and they were pretty big, but the pot was gone from the middle of the table and nobody knew where it was. And there's like 9 players plus a dealer sitting at the table and they're asking me, what do we do? And I'm like, you know, what do you mean the pot is gone? You know, and they're saying, and every player was saying, I didn't touch it. I didn't touch it. The dealer saying, I didn't touch it. Hang on. How can 9 of you be sitting here and not know where a substantial pot is? It wasn't a small pot. You know, this is a substantial pot. And we had to like retrace, okay, well, look, you know, who was involved in the last hand? You know, because if you're involved with another player in the hand, you're going to look at his chips so you know where you stand. And we were like trying to retrace the last 5 or 6 hands, trying to retrace, well, whose stack doesn't look right, you know? Now, eventually we got there and one guy kind of said, look, yeah, I think maybe I had too
much.
You think you might have too many chips. So we kind of agreed a rough figure that he was somewhat amicable about removing the stack and giving to another guy. But like, I mean, we were there for 20 minutes trying to figure out where's the pot gone and how can nine of you and Dieter not know where the pot went, you know? And that was probably my weirdest and most difficult moment at a poker table, yeah.
It wasn't with Kasouf, no.
I don't know who it was. I don't know who it was.
Name and shame if you can, definitely the person who went, I didn't realize they were there.
No, one of them knew where the pot was. Funny.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, look, Go on.
Most of the time when we're called to the table, usually it's black and white. Maybe a player is very unhappy about it and he'll argue. And, you know, we usually say to him, look, I can't stand here arguing with you. You're welcome to come up to my desk and I'll explain my decision, you know, but we're not going to stand here arguing about it for the next hour. It's done, you know.
I've been sent to your desk a couple of times up here.
Well, you voluntarily came to the desk.
I probably am one of the more litigious people, and I do like my. This is why I love having you on the show. I love all these little finickety rule things. This is great. Should I have a whole show dedicated?
A lot of the time as well, to be honest, the hardest part of roulette can be getting the accurate information. You know, sometimes you come down, maybe a dealer doesn't have fantastic English, or maybe, you know, the dealer is under a lot of pressure with everybody screaming and they're, you know, they're nervous, they're a little bit rattly, and it can sometimes be just very hard to find out exactly what happened. So one of my tricks that I do in Amindo situations is, usually when I think I have a good picture of what's happened, I'll usually say it back to the table. So I'll usually say, okay, so the button was on C2, you were small blind, you were big blind. C4 raised, 5 called, and then 6 did whatever, and that's when the chips went in, and that's when we noticed blah, blah, blah. And most of the time the players will go, yeah, that's what happened. And sometimes they can say, no, that's not right, you know, this guy raised before he folded, you know, and we get our picture. But I find it very helpful to just say the situation back to the table, that this is what I'm basing my decision on. Is this what happened?
Yeah. No, and your demeanor is better than anyone else in the game that I know when it comes to those kind of spots, because a lot of the time you might be giving bad news to someone who feels like the ruling's going against them. Maybe occasionally you'll be wrong, but I have no doubt 99% of the time you're going to be right. Yeah. And you just have to accept it. It's like a referee in any scenario. You just have to accept the decision in the end of the day. Yeah. And it's easier to accept coming from someone like you, I think.
Thank you. And I think the big thing is, we're not going to stand here all day talking about it and debating it. You know, I'm walking away. I'm not being rude.
I feel like you're really speaking.
You're welcome to talk to me over there, but we're not going to stand here all day talking about it.
Nice stuff. Well, look, I'm going to do a clunky segue over to online poker, where, of course, the chips could never go missing because it's just all there in cyberspace. It's all done for you. A couple of very big series are just about to end, but no rest for the wicked, Dara O'Carney. The US begins on Sunday, overlapping with all these other series. I know you plan to play it all and try and win the coveted high and overall leaderboards. You've been crushing lately, as I mentioned, multiple 20k plus scores in the last 10 days, and every night you seem to win something. I wanted to ask you one question, though, that I think might serve as a tip as well to people in our audience. Unibet has effectively anonymous tables thanks to players' abilities to change their aliases. Unibet does not permit HUDs or any other sort of software assistance. Unibet is also probably a little more recreational with fewer pros gobbling up all the value. With those factors in mind, how do you adjust your game on there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Obviously, the no HUDs thing is, I mean, more and more sites are kind of moving that way anyway. And the fact that you don't know who you're playing against, to be honest, that doesn't change things too much for me, because when I'm playing online, traditionally I've been playing so many tables that I don't even notice. And sometimes people will say to me, oh, that hand we just played. And I'll like, oh, did we just play a hand? Because everybody is just numbers on a screen to me. And that's what I'm looking at. I'm not even looking at their avatar or anything else or recognizing their name. That's obviously easier. And that's even more the case on Unibet, where everybody can use different aliases and so on. So what I tend to do in that situation is I just, you know, I have a standard game as close to game theory as I can get. And I only deviate from that when I notice something at the table. If something goes to showdown and somebody turns up with a hand they really shouldn't have, I'll obviously factor that into future decisions in pots against that player. Frequencies will be a thing as well. You know, if somebody's opening every hand, you play against them differently than somebody who you haven't seen put a chip into a pot yet. So you do kind of have to pay more close attention. I guess it moves closer to live poker, where you're sort of trying to pay attention to whoever's at the table. I also think that the anonymous thing probably isn't that big a deal. Like some players feel that they're incredibly well protected if they have an anonymous thing, but you know, they have a game style which says that they're playing 80% of pots, and that becomes very apparent very quickly. So, you know, people will still play against you as that type of player. And the other thing is, you know, even we all know that misconceptions or preconceptions can be a hindrance as well as a help. Sometimes you play against somebody and you base your decisions off how you saw them the last time you played them. This is particularly a thing live. But if it was a long time ago, they could be a very different player nowadays, or they might just be playing differently today for whatever reason. They feel like playing more pots or whatever. So you kind of have to just see what people are doing on the day. That's actually the most important information. And you know, the anonymous stuff or the HUD stuff doesn't change that. If you're very observant to what's happening at the table, that's where most of your edge will come from.
That's great advice. Well, the US will run from September 12th until September 27th, culminating, of course, with the hotly anticipated €1,100 Unibet Open Online two-day event. There will be the usual leaderboards, overall, high, medium, low, and nano. So tons of added value there for players of all stake levels. This Saturday, September 11th, Dara, there will be a special curtain raiser for the US festival. The Chip Race PKO tournament starts at 7 p.m. UK time, and it will feature guest Alex O'Brien. Now, people may remember Alex gave us a great interview on the Chip Race a few months ago. She is a science writer and poker player who is working on a poker book right now. She won the Dan Bilzerian free roll back in December and wrote about that experience and more in an article for BBC World. Well worth checking out if you haven't, but it went viral a few months ago, so you probably have read it already. Nick, are you going to play our special tournament on Saturday? We are going to take this opportunity to cordially invite you to it.
I wouldn't miss it for the world. I'll be there. I'll be playing an IPO satellite as well, but I will be there.
Absolutely, yes. IPO satellites will be starting this weekend as well. £5 feeder satellites, or even £1 to £5 feeder satellites. Sure. So you can play the
third today. Yeah, Thursday night they start.
That's right. And then the Sunday finals for those will be £33 events we're going to generate six, seven, yeah, eight.
Typically, Unibet qualify about 100 qualifiers for the IPO. So, yeah, we would expect kind of in the region of 100 qualifiers again this year.
Absolutely. He's some man. I was trying to do a thing about our chip race thing. And he's immediately dragged it back to his IPO. Yeah, there's some man for keeping the advertising going. Like Helmut, he's taking a leaf out of his book. This chip race tournament, I just want to let people know, because it is a bit of a special one for us. It has a 13K guarantee. It's a £50 buy-in. And we are managing to, you know, dig deep into the pockets of Unibet here for over £2,000 in added prizes. What are those prizes, you may ask? Well, the top 35 players, finishers, if you like, in this event will win US seats worth between €5 and €25. So a little bit of something back there. Not only that, but there's a really cool promotion here. If you win the tourney or knock out Dara, myself, Ian, or Alex, you get entered into a sit and go played on Saturday, the 25th of September, where the winner will take home a Unibet Open online ticket, €1,100 in value. Dara, Ian, Alex, and myself will also be playing in that sit and go. If Ian wins, the prize will go to his community, as it will for ours if Dara or I emerge triumphant. But hopefully one of the qualifiers wins, because that's the best story of the lot, I think. Isn't that right, Dara? No, actually, if we win.
Yeah, no, actually, no. What I'm hoping happens here is that I knock out all three of you, and then I'm the only person in the tournament.
And then win the tournament too. Yeah, that is the way to do it, actually. That would do it all right. One final question, Dara. I've been talking to Alex, and she is really excited about being our special guest, which is wonderful. I've tried to explain to her that it is just our way of trying to wedge ourselves into a chapter of her book.
Yeah, we failed miserably to get ourselves into the Maria Konnikova's book. And we kind of realized that it's not just enough to be friends with people. You have to actually give them some sort of incentive. So I think we've learned from that debacle, and now we're more savvy, let's say. I mean, Alex is wonderful. You might have people in the poker world saying, well, why didn't you get a big name pro rather than Alex? But the reality is that in terms of reach to people outside of poker, or people only very slightly engaged by poker, Alex actually has a lot more reach than most of the big name pros who really only appeal to those 1,000 people that I mentioned earlier who are already very engaged with poker Twitter. She's really thrown herself into it too as well. She actually sent me a tweet yesterday after I mentioned her bounty, saying, hands off my bounty, that's not up for grabs. So she's taking this very seriously. I love Alex. She's a typically German, very forthright, competitive lady who has competed at a high level in triathlons as well. So she's somebody I feel is sort of a kindred spirit.
Absolutely, she is. Well, a final wrap-up of a few stories from this week. Former guest of the show, Espen Jorstad, has made the final table of the WSOP main event online. He is guaranteed a whopping 250 grand, and he plays for 2.5 million on Saturday night. Check that out. Doyle Brunson is working on a documentary about his life. Details, are limited for now, but word is it is being made by Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Jason Hare, and the people who produced the superb Michael Jordan documentary that I'm sure we all watched during lockdown last year, The Last Dance. A reminder once again that the qualifiers for the IPO, see, I was going to do it anyway, it's in my script here, Nick, begin this Sunday at 8 p.m. Irish time, and they will take place every Sunday at that same time until mid-October. It remains for me to thank Dara O'Carney and our special guest this week, Nick O'Hara. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, guys. That was fun.
Thanks, Dave and Nick.
Thanks, lads.